The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
The building is mined and it explodes and eventually goes on fire. And this has a lasting effect on the local population.
As we continue our series on the Irish War of Independence, tonight we turn our focus to one of the most active and intense theatres in that conflict, Dublin.
Being involved in an ambush in a rural part of County Cork is one thing, but you know, taking a man from a tram and shooting him dead in a public street is something a little bit different.
We'll hear about the 12 Apostles, more commonly known as the Squad, Michael Collins' assassination unit, which targeted key figures in the British intelligence network. Plus,
one of the sadder aspects of the story is that the GAA had gotten some sense and some notice that something might occur.
But I could hear the bullets whizzing. I thought that it was blanks that were firing.
Bloody Sunday, one of the most violent days in the War of Independence, when the Squad carried out an audacious series of coordinated shootings on unsuspecting British agents. And the carnage that followed at Croke Park, when the Crown Forces carried out a brutal reprisal, opening fire on a crowd of innocent civilians. But we begin this evening at 6 Harcourt Street in Dublin. There stands an elegant Georgian townhouse that today serves as the headquarters of Conradh na Gaeilge. The building has a long association with the nationalist movement, serving at one time as the headquarters of Sinn Féin and as the Dáil's ministerial offices in the early part of the war. Earlier, Lorcan Clancy visited 6 Harcourt Street to meet curator Cúin O'Sheridan and find out more about the building's revolutionary heritage.
This house has played many roles since it was built in the late 18th century. It was originally the home of the Blackwoods, a family of landed gentry. It once hosted a Catholic university, which was the precursor of UCD. And in the early 1860s, it was a prep school for aspiring British Army officers.
It turns out that the house ends up playing an extraordinary role, paralleling the great events of Irish history from the Act of Union onwards.
In 1910, the house was purchased by Tom Kelly, a Sinn Féin alderman for Dublin City.
And Kelly thought that the house would be a good place to help the Sinn Féin bank to grow and also to provide space for a party that they hoped was going to expand over the following years. The Sinn Féin movement was quite small at that time, and it was a coalition of various groups. There was a lot of discussion going on within the party, so lectures were a very important feature of the culture of the party and the way they were doing things at that time.
In the following years, the house served as a meeting place for charitable groups, protest movements, and of course, various Republican organisations.
First aid classes are held here by Cumann na mBan in the years before the Rising. It's also a place where Cumann na mBan meetings take place, focusing on the south of the city.
During the Rising, the house was occupied by British troops.
Because it's on a strategic approach to Stephen's Green, between Stephen's Green and Portobello Barracks. And Margaret Skinner reports that the shots that injured her, and she's the only woman who's injured as a combatant in the 1916 Rising, that they were actually fired from the Sinn Féin bank.
In the years following the Rising, there was a huge increase in traffic through Number 6. As Sinn Féin moved in a more explicitly Republican direction, activities at the party headquarters didn't go unnoticed by British intelligence, and the house was subject to numerous raids.
It's a key target for the intelligence services. They have very strong opinions about the people who are working in this building and the role that they're playing in, according to them, the destabilisation of Ireland at that time.
The house was the strategic nerve centre of Sinn Féin's election campaign at the end of 1918.
The first thing that happens, though, in this building is that it's attacked by a mob on the night of the 13th of November. A mob gathers outside and stones and bricks are thrown at the building, and there's an attempt made to set the place on fire. The house was pretty badly battered, but it wasn't breached and it wasn't set on fire. There was a bit of vicious fighting in the hallway downstairs. And it is important to remember that there were quite a lot of loyalists in Dublin in 1918 and 1919. This Sinn Féin headquarters in South Dublin was not in an area which was completely sympathetic to what they were doing. They might have been more comfortable if the headquarters had been somewhere else.
In the early months of the breakaway republic in 1919, Number 6 served as the de facto ministerial offices for the government. Michael Collins used an office here to administrate the Dáil loan.
Because raising taxes was quite difficult in the situation they were in, the decision was made that they would borrow the money, they would sell bonds, they would try to get people to invest in the idea of an Irish Republic. All of the documents were designed for this, and all of the marketing was a very important part of this, all of that was conceived in these walls.
On the 12th of September 1919, there was a major raid on the building. The British government had finally decided to completely shut down Dáil Éireann.
And part of that is to come in here in force and arrest a couple of people and disrupt the activities in the headquarters. And there's an incident which takes place in Michael Collins' office where Inspector Neil McFeely comes into the office and encounters Collins.
This incident was recalled by Eveline Lawless, secretary to Michael Collins, in her witness statement to the Bureau of Military History.
Mick said, "We're caught like rats in a trap and there's no escape." He remained seated at his desk, quite calm and collected, till they came in. One of the police inspectors, I think Love was his name, had a special commission to capture Collins. But it was Inspector McFeely who came to our room, looking a little bit frightened. He went round searching the different desks and seemed desperately anxious to finish his task and get out.
She describes how there's an altercation between the two of them, and Collins starts a political discussion with McFeely. McFeely is Irish, and McFeely is probably a home ruler rather than a unionist. And McFeely gives out to Collins about how Sinn Féin have ruined the Irish party, and Collins pushes back.
Mick sat very casually on his desk with one leg swinging and told him in no measured terms what sort of work he was engaged on. He was scathing in his remarks about it. "What sort of legacy will you leave to your family looking for blood money? Could you not find some honest work to do?" Inspector was writhing under the attack.
When McFeely enters that room, he's encountering the Minister for Finance for the First Dáil in his office. There must have been a lot of paper evidence in the room. He probably had the best chance any police officer or military person had during the War of Independence to capture the key military and the key financial figure on the Irish side. And he failed. And the big question is, did he fail because he was incompetent, or did he fail because he was hedging his bets, wondering how things were going to turn out in the future?
Collins was ultimately not arrested, and it's still unclear whether or not McFeely, the Dublin Metropolitan Police Inspector, knew who he was talking to.
We can't ever know for sure, but perhaps McFeely did recognise Collins and let him go. But whatever the truth of it, he certainly had the best chance, and it's certainly the only case we have where Collins, at his workplace, is in a conversation, in an altercation with a police officer, and doesn't get captured.
After that raid, most of the senior people, like Collins, avoided 6 Harcourt Street, as it was considered too dangerous.
When we talk about the GPO, for example, which is such a symbolic building and such an important, significant building in the story of how the Irish state came to be, people were in there for 6 days. But in the case of this building, they were here for 12 years. And all of the key personalities were associated with this building in some ways. Key encounters, key meetings took place, key decisions were made here. And the most important decision that was made here was not just the idea of creating an independent Irish Parliament, but the actual decision to found Dáil Éireann was made here. And that makes this house probably the most significant house in historical terms in this city.
Lorcan Clancy was reporting there from 6 Harcourt Street in Dublin, speaking to Cúan O'Sheridan about the important role of that building in the early days of the Irish Republic. And now, appropriately, it's Cian Áras Cronan na Gaeilge. I'll be joined throughout this programme by 3 guests. Brian Hughes is a lecturer in history at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. Cathy Scuffle, Dublin City Council historian in residence for the South Central area. And from our Cork studio, I'm joined by Michael Foley, a journalist with the Sunday Times, a member of the GAA's History and Commemorations Committee, and the author of the 2014 book The Bloodied Field, an account of Bloody Sunday in Croke Park in November 1920. You're all very welcome indeed to the programme. Cathy, let's stay with 1919 for the moment. You've been researching local incidents in the city as the conflict began, before it really starts to intensify.
Yeah, that's very true, Miles. When you look at the newspaper accounts in particular, you can see a very slow build-up of incidents. So early on in the year, you get reports of shootings, like shots have been fired, or accounts of maybe a small raid taking place somewhere, something like that. Then you hear of military motor lorries and they are speeding around the city. So there's been a couple of incidents with them. Now, there was a young chap killed on near Charlemont Bridge by a lorry, and in the inquiry after his death, it's found that the military are at fault. The lorry in question was travelling at about 45 miles an hour through city streets. So you get a sense from that that the military were tense. You can feel the tension rising. There's another incident of a young girl called Violet Pearson. She's the daughter of a Church of Ireland missionary, and she's cycling on the South Circle Road near her home at Dolphin's Barn, and she again is knocked down by a military lorry. Now, how I came across her story wasn't so much a newspaper account, though I did find it there later on. There's a memorial bench to her in the Church of Ireland Church in Donore Avenue. So it had a huge effect on that community, who were recovering from World War One incidents, and now a young girl from their community is killed by, of all things, a military motor lorry on the road. So you see those tensions rising, incidents like that, all through the newspapers.
And Brian, you're working currently on the Dublin volume in the County by County Irish Revolution series from Four Courts Press. And I imagine it's important, or is it important, to draw a distinction between what's taking place in the city of Dublin and the wider county of Dublin?
I think the first thing we need to avoid is forgetting that the county exists or forgetting that anything happens there. It's very easy to focus exclusively on the city. The city's associated with a lot of the iconic figures, a lot of the key events. And in some ways, that distinction between city and county makes sense, because in many ways, there's a different sort of war that takes place beyond the city boundaries. In North County Dublin or in South Dublin, the kind of war you see there is much closer to what you have in Meath or Kildare or Wicklow. So you have the kind of things you'd associate with war in rural areas, like attacks on RIC patrols, attacks on RIC barracks, drilling,
closing
parading.
Down, presumably, of the more remote ones, even in the county of Dublin. Yeah,
yeah, and they're burned then as well, along where they're burned elsewhere in the country as well. You also get something like Balbriggan. In a way, Balbriggan is a bit like a microcosm of the sort of war that you see elsewhere as well, in the sense that two RIC officers are shot dead in a pub in Balbriggan. There's a massive black and tan reprisal where the city is sacked, huge damage to property, massive compensation bills racked up after that. But that kind of leads to a cycle then of sort of tit for tat violence that follows in the months afterwards. So you have the sack of Balbriggan itself, but in Skerry's Balbriggan, Rush, Lusk, these areas, we get lots of smaller events, house burnings. We have, for example, the shooting of an ex-soldier, William Straw, who's supposed to have been, he's alleged at least to have been involved in the reprisal at Balbriggan. That's followed a little bit later on then by the shooting of Thomas Hand, who's a member of the IRA, and he's taken out of his brother's house in Skerry's in December 1920 and shot dead. And like you get elsewhere, large parts of County Dublin are quiet for large portions of the war, but you get these kind of outbursts of violence. So it can be one incident can spark lots of incidents that follow on. So in that sense, what's going on in the city is a very different kind of war. It's much more intense, a lot more frequent, and a lot more impersonal as well.
So the Fingal Brigade, North Dublin, for example, would be more like Longford, Roscommon, that kind of activity.
Exactly, and they're a separate brigade altogether as well. So the Dublin Brigade has four battalions in the city. Later on in the war, they create a 6th and a 7th battalions that operate in South County Dublin. But actually, Fingal operates in a totally different, its own command structure. It's got its own battalions, its own units. And it's actually part of the 1st Eastern Division, whereas the Dublin Brigade is part of the 2nd Eastern Division. So there is that sort of disconnect there even.
Michael, when it comes to the GAA and to activity within the GAA, how was that affected? I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about the events of Bloody Sunday and the challenge match between Dublin and Tipperary in Croke Park. But were there still a lot of games going on, or did everything just grind to a halt?
It was kind of a gradual process, I suppose. I suppose coming into 1919, we say competitions, we say in Dublin, for example, went along fine, but out in the countryside, things were slowing down. I mean, in Tipperary, for example, it was getting a hell of a lot more difficult to play games the longer the year went on. In terms of, I suppose, the big stuff, your All-Ireland Championships and so on and so forth, like the 1918 final would have been delayed by Spanish flu anyway. So that was played in February 19 by Tip and Wexford. So that went through fine. By the time you got through to 1920, you do see a sort of, as I say, a slowing up around the place. Again, though, the GAA had kind of would have been quite happy that they had completed a lot of games by the middle of the summertime. But as, I suppose, things get more tense, particularly in the countryside and things like the Terence McSweeney hunger strike and so on, which, for example, Cork would have pulled out of everything when Terence McSweeney was going through his hunger strike, particularly in Munster, things would have slowed down. Dublin managed to win their Leinster football title by the summertime that particular year. But by the time it came to playing an All-Ireland semi-final for 1920, which would have been Cavan, that game was actually convened at 2 days' notice because everything in Ulster had stopped and the GAA reckoned we're not going to get to play this game. But suddenly they saw a little window in September and they called both sides and said, we're going to play the game in Navan in 2 days' time. They literally got a call on a Friday to play the game on a Sunday. Cavan weren't too happy. But again, it's interesting when you look at the newspaper reports and the contemporary accounts from the time. They still drew huge crowds. I mean, Navan ground to a halt that day for that game, even though Dublin won it quite comfortably and that. But people were still, once there was a game on, people were still really keen to go. But we'll say by the time of the Dublin-Tipperary Challenge game and the Bloody Sunday Day, games had more or less ground to a halt. So as a result, a game like Dublin-Tip would have drawn a very big crowd because people were starved of games.
Mm, indeed. Cathy, you've talked to us before in the programme about the events of the Irish Revolutionary period as they relate to specific areas of Dublin, like Ballyfermot, Dolphin's Barn, places like that. And there were some incidents you wanted to draw our attention to, an attack on a railway near Ballyfermot, for example.
That's correct. That comes towards the end. And in fact, in a way, it may be linked to the calling of the actual truce because it was a pretty horrific incident on the Killeen Bridge, which is quite well known in the Ballyfermot area, railway bridge. They had word that a military troop train was leaving Kingsbridge, Houston, today and heading towards the Curragh. And they lie in wait for it and attack it from the bridge. Now, the attack isn't just a few shots fired. It's petrol-soaked sacks thrown down on top of the train as it passes under the bridge, and the IRA are installed on the embankments beside the train as it goes by. The initial dropping items on the train is to slow it down, so it does start to break, and the sacks are full of petrol and flammable items in it, and the shots actually set the entire train on fire. Now, it continues its journey. It is stated that it pulls in at Clondalkin and some of the injured people on board are taken out, but most of those on board are taken to the Curragh. And there is no details that I can find of the number of casualties from that incident. But it's pretty horrific incident.
Also, something called the destruction of the halfway house. There are lots of halfway houses in Ireland. I imagine this one is a public house.
Well, it was. And it was a very popular public house. And the destruction of the pub was going to have a big effect on the local area, no matter what happened. But the reason why it happened is probably...
But where is this, by the way?
Okay, first of all, the halfway house, all the Southsiders will know this. It's near... on the road out of Dublin, so the Crumlin-Drimna Road, beyond where present-day Our Lady's Hospital is,
right.
It's a junction. So the left junction brings you towards Talla and the right junction significantly links you up with the Naas Road. And it is that particular location, it's a well-known inn in the area, and that particular location meant that it was a landmark. It was being used as a safe house. It was also being used as a place to attack lorries that were transporting personnel and materials out to the construction of Baldonnell, which was underway at the time. Now, there's a couple of very interesting accounts about you could hear the lorries long before they arrived because the British soldiers would be singing army songs as they were coming up the Crumlin Road and making themselves targets. So there was quite a number of incidents at that point where the lorries were intercepted and taken up to the Dublin Mountains and destroyed. And it's obviously the combination of all of those incidents that led to the final account, which was middle of the night, 1921. The occupants are evacuated out of the house. That is Mrs. Conway, her sister Mrs. Yates, and Mrs. Yates' two sons are taken out of the house by men who have blackened faces and have their heads covered. And the building is mined and it explodes and eventually goes on fire. And this has a lasting effect on the local population, not least in that they salvage certain items out of the pub, such as the tiles from the floor. Certain older cottages in the area will actually point out the lovely new garden path they got as a result of the destruction of the pub. But it had a huge effect on the area because this big landmark was completely destroyed.
We can assume that the gentlemen who arrived in blackened faces were not the IRA.
They definitely were not. No, right. They definitely were not.
Now, Brian, one of the early goals of the IRA in Dublin, and there were, I think, a couple of attempts, one spectacular one and to some extent a spectacular failure, were attempts to assassinate Lord French. Lord French was the Lord Lieutenant. Normally it's a symbolic role only, but I mean, French was a different type of Lord Lieutenant. I mean, this is somebody who is basically sent over to put manners on the IRA, isn't he?
He is, and he's going to be saying a lot of things very publicly that members of the IRA aren't going to want to hear. So, yeah, it's one of the first major attempts, I suppose, at an assassination by a member of the Dublin Brigade. And as I say, it doesn't go very well. There are a mix of people involved. Dan Breen, who happens to be in the area, he gets involved in it as well. And really, it doesn't go at all to plan. A couple of things go wrong. It takes the convoy arrive a little bit quicker at the ambush point at Ashtown than the IRA men had been hoping they might. Also, Lord French, it happens to be, very luckily for him, travelling in a different car to the one he'd been expected to be travelling in. A firefight assumed between armed Crown Forces and the IRA, and that leads to the wounding of Breen. Breen managed to escape but is quite badly wounded. But Martin Savage, who's a young volunteer from Galway, is killed.
And reading accounts of some of the people who were involved, one of the things that really perplexed them and annoyed them was that they had to leave Martin Savage's body in situ. They didn't have time to evacuate his body.
Sure. And I suppose that maybe brings home the realities of this sort of guerrilla warfare as well, and how inexperienced these kind of guys are. So in 1919, this is still a very new type of warfare. And the fact that something like that sticks with these people, I think, tells you a little bit about some of the strains and the pressures of fighting that kind of war.
One of the people who was actually involved in that ambush, which attempted to assassinate Lord French, was Vincent Byrne, better known as Vinnie Byrne. And Vinnie Byrne, probably one of the most famous of the members of the squad. Tell us about the squad. Why was it formed? When was it formed? What was so special about the squad?
The squad was first formed in July 1919, and it was formalised then in September. And initially it consisted of 12 men who get that kind of famous moniker, the 12 Apostles. And really, the job of the squad was to act as an assassination unit. Their job was to take out targets that Michael Collins and others had identified. So it's a very different kind of unit to any others, really, certainly in Dublin, but also elsewhere, in the sense that their job really is just to take out targeted individuals. And it involves a type of killing that is very different to what you see anywhere else. So there's something, being involved in an ambush in a rural part of County Cork is one thing, but, you know, taking a man from a tram and shooting him dead in a public street is something a little bit different. And it took a certain type of individual first to be asked to be involved in the squad, but then also to stay in the squad as well. So really, they are a kind of an iconic unit in the Dublin IRA. And in one way, they're an extremely important part of the war in Dublin. But really, they're not representative of the experience of most who are in the Dublin Brigade.
Indeed. As I said, Vinnie Byrne was one of the so-called 12 Apostles, one of the dozen members of the infamous Dublin IRA assassination squad working to Collins as Director of Intelligence. In his witness statement, Byrne talked about his induction into the squad. He was asked to participate in the killing of a Dublin Metropolitan Police detective, John Barton, later murdered close to the Great Brunswick Street base of the Dublin Metropolitan Police's G Division.
One evening about November 1919, I was down at Mick MacDonald's house. Also present were Tom Keown and Jimmy Slattery sitting at the fire. As I went in, Mick said to me, "How are you going on?" I replied, "Well." After a few minutes, he said to me, "Would you shoot a man, Byrne?" I replied, "Well, it's all according to who he was." He said, "What about Johnny Barton?" "Oh," I said, "I wouldn't mind. Has he raided my house?" So Mick said, "That settles it. You may have the chance." A selected number of men were picked and mobilised to attend a meeting, the majority of the men being members of the 2nd Battalion. When all had assembled, the object of the meeting was to explain to them. There was no compulsion whatsoever on any man. He could volunteer or decline such work. In fact, one or two men conscientiously objected, one stating that he would have no hesitation in going out to face the enemy in open battle.
In March 1920, Byrne actually gave up his job and began to work full-time for the squad. He was paid £4.10 a week.
All operations carried out by the unofficial squad took place under cover of the dark evenings, and naturally the British authorities knew this. Therefore, their agents and officials made sure that they would not be caught out after the fall of evening, but would carry on with their dirty work during daylight. This applied especially where extreme action had to be taken, as the majority of the volunteers were working men. It was very hard to expect them to be able to leave their employment at any hour of the day. There was no alternative but to form a full-time squad. As already stated, we were all just working for our living. Therefore, the full-time men would have to be paid. The wages paid were in keeping with the amount that they would receive if they were working for their ordinary employers.
The words there of one of the so-called 12 apostles, Vinnie Byrne. Michael, one of the squad's particular targets was something called the Cairo Gang. Now, I'm curious about the Cairo Gang. Did any such group as the Cairo Gang actually exist? Because there are lots of doubts about whether they did or whether they didn't, or whether there ever was anything called the Cairo Gang.
Yeah, it's a kind of a commonly used moniker, all right, to kind of describe a particular group, usually the group that were killed on Bloody Sunday morning, but it's a little bit broader than that. Like around May 1920, General Sir Armand Winter had started to really pull things together in terms of intelligence in Dublin Castle. And in the following 9 months from May 20, you're talking about around 60, certainly 60 and up to 100 agents being brought into Ireland to try and infiltrate the IRA and try and upset their operations. So a lot of those guys would have hung out at a place called the Cairo Cafe, which was near Grafton Street. So I suppose that's where the common term, the Cairo Gang, came from. But I mean, these guys, you know, again, from reading the witness statements from a lot of the IRA people and looking at what the spies and agents managed to accomplish, they got really, really close to Collins and his inner circle, to a point that I think by the time Bloody Sunday came around, okay, Bloody Sunday has been sort of remembered now, the morning aspect of it, as a kind of a great blow by the IRA. But to me, it often reminded me of a boxer kind of on the ropes who needed to do something, because they were getting very, very close. David Nelligan, one of Collins' great contacts in Dublin Castle, told a fascinating story about bringing Frank Thornton, Tom Cullen and Frank Sorin to Kid's Bar, which was another hangout for Black and Tan's auxiliary spies agents. Kid's Bar is actually still a bar there. It's the Porter House now, opposite Trinity College. But he brought the guys there and introduced them to some agents and auxiliaries and said, "These men will help you. They're informers. You know, they will provide you with information on the IRA." So they managed to create a bit of a relationship. But at some point, anyway, they were in conversation with some auxiliaries and they were talking about Collins. And one agent asked after Liam Tobin, Cullen and Thornton, and they said, "We're so close to getting these guys, we just need a positive ID." And he was actually talking to Cullen and Thornton at that point, and Liam Tobin was just a few hundred yards away in Crow Street. So I mean, they were that close to getting at them. So, and these spies and agents were also going out, and they were performing in the same way that the squad were performing hits. Occasionally the British would hit back in a similar way. There was a story of a Sinn Féin councillor from Limerick called John Lynch, who came up to Dublin to give Collins £23,000 in subscriptions, IRA subscriptions, and they killed him.
I think they thought he was Liam Lynch, didn't they?
I think that possibly was it, but the point remains the same. They were actively going out now and trying to upset matters. They were bringing policemen up from the country to identify IRA men who might have been in Dublin at the time. So, and in the end, they got Sean Tracy, obviously, in October 1920, who was basically resident in Dublin at that point, with Breen, who was still recovering from those injuries we mentioned before. So, like, by the time you're kind of heading into the second half of 1920, it was getting very, very, very tense in terms of IRA activity and in terms of the level of infiltration they could actually achieve at that point. So I think down the years, I think Bloody Sunday in particular and that aspect with the agents in the morning has become quite black and white. I think there's a hell of a lot of grey there in terms of where the IRA were at that time.
OK, we'll talk about Bloody Sunday after the break, and we'll talk about the squad's involvement in that. They weren't the only unit or the only group involved in that. They were augmented by elements of the Dublin Brigade. But we're going to talk now about one specific and quite brutal assassination carried out by the squad. Vinnie Byrne, one of the squad members, as I said, involved in the assassination of somebody who was, in effect, he was a magistrate, but in effect, in this instance, he was an accountant, Alan Bell, whose investigations imperiled the finances of the Sinn Féin administration.
This man came from England. His job was to examine the banking accounts in order to find out where the volunteer money was. As this was a danger to the movement, orders were given to the squad that he was to be got out of the way. Information was received that Bell was living out at Monkstown. Tom Keogh was sent out on his bicycle to Monkstown. The squad, along with some intelligence officers, proceeded to Aylesbury Road and awaited developments. Tom's job was to watch and see what tram Bell would board. He was to follow it and give the signal to the men at Aylesbury Road that Bell was aboard. Bell boarded the tram at Monkstown, and Tom, keeping pace along with it, gave the signal that he was inside this particular tram. The squad boarded the tram, the majority going inside. I was detailed to go on top. My job was to cut the trolley rope when I heard any commotion going on below. When we got as far as Simmons Court Road, Bell was pulled off the tram. The conductor rushed upstairs shouting, "There's going to be a man shot." I said to him, "Oh, let me down off this tram," at the same time cutting the trolley rope. The actual place where Bell was shot was the corner of Simmons Court Road, at the corner of the showgrounds.
Brian, we heard there Vinnie Byrne's account of the shooting of Alan Bell. Why was he a danger? Why did he become a target?
Simple answer is money. And what you can see with the shooting of Bell, if we compare that what we talked about earlier with the shooting of French, this is, you know, very, very different types of target. French is that symbolic figure, whereas Bell is going after the money. And the money is crucial to keeping both the Dáil counter state going, but also to keeping the IRA going. Vinnie Byrne is being paid £4.10 a week, for example, along with his colleagues in the squad and in the ASU. And really, the Dáil needs money to keep going. So somebody investigating that money is a problem. And that's really why he needs to be taken out. So in one sense, it's kind of a very ruthless target. You know, he's a magistrate. He's unarmed. He's not involved in the military conflict. But it's still seen as imperative that he's taken out.
Now, there are a number of high-profile hits, that's one of them, in Dublin, and there are a number of high-profile operations. For example, the one we will talk about after the break, which is Bloody Sunday. You also had the operation in which Kevin Barry was captured and then subsequently executed. You had the engagement that Michael has just talked about in which Sean Tracy is killed. But tell us about something perhaps not quite as well known, something that you've looked at, you've researched, and that's an ambush in Drumcondra in January of 1921.
Yeah, the Drumcondra ambush is, I think, a nice example of the sort of war that you see in Dublin. It brings together a lot of the elements that help us understand how the war looks in Dublin. It's one of the earliest operations carried out by the Active Service Unit, which is basically a unit set up to be full-time gunmen whose job is to engage British forces whenever they can find them. And this particular
normally would be called a flying column. I mean, in the rest of the country, an active service unit was a flying column, really, wasn't it?
They are essentially, and in a way, the main difference in Dublin is that they get paid.
Yeah.
But really, they're doing the same kind of job as the flying columns are doing elsewhere. And this particular ambush is led by Frank Flood, who's a 19-year-old engineering student, whose father actually had been a pensioner from the Dublin Metropolitan Police, so maybe an unlikely candidate for the job, but a very active and enthusiastic member of the IRA. And this ambush is, again, it's an example. It shows if someone like Catherine Byrne, for example, who brings the weapons to Drumcondra for the ambush, she's an example of that role that women play that gets written out or is kind of ignored in a lot of the accounts.
She ran a safe house, basically, Richmond Street.
And she's doing this hugely important work, and she's one of these women without whom ambushes can't even be attempted. But, you know, she has to tell the story herself, and the story comes out from her own account rather than from the accounts of others. But she brings the weapons in her shopping bag hidden under her cabbages, which is a nice way to do it, I think. A nice touch, the cabbages. The police may be not interested in searching through bags of cabbages. But militarily, the ambush, as it turns out, is a bit of a disaster. The idea was to attack patrols of RIC coming between the city and Gormanstown Depot. And they actually miss one intended target but decide to stay and hang on for another. But unfortunately for them, they get tipped off by a vigilant member of the Dublin Metropolitan Police who happens to be in the area. And one of the survivors of the ambush tells of how this DMP sergeant was left alone, essentially, because the remit was not to attack the DMP. So he was let go about his way. He went and told his colleagues. And as a lorry is coming from Gormanston towards the city, they decide to attack it. But at the same time, a group of auxiliaries are coming the other way from the city. So Flood and his men throw a couple of grenades at the lorry coming from Gormanstown. It speeds off. But very shortly afterwards, they're fired on by these auxiliaries who've arrived from the city. One of the men, Michael McGee, is shot and wounded. He dies a couple of days later. But five are captured, including Flood and Dermot O'Sullivan, who leaves a witness statement afterwards. Allegedly, according to O'Sullivan, at least they were interrogated by the so-called IGO gang. They're eventually court-martialed and found guilty of levying war against the king and of high treason. And four of the men are executed on the 14th of March 1921, along with two of those who were arrested after Bloody Sunday. The youngest, O'Sullivan, his sentence is commuted owing to his age. But in that one failed ambush, the Dublin IRA lose five men killed. And that accounts for near enough 10% of all they lose in the entire war. So it's very significant in that regard. And it shows the dangers of operations like that. And, you know, it's one of a few failed ambushes carried out by the Dublin Brigade.
OK, we're going to take a quick break now. And when we return, we will talk about the 21st of November 1920, the day of violence in Dublin, which has gone down in history as Bloody Sunday.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. We're talking about Dublin and the War of Independence as part of our series on the War of Independence. My guests are Michael Foley, Cathy Scuffle and Brian Hughes. And we're going to turn now to one of the most significant and consequential days of the war, the 21st of November 1920, a day of intense violence in Dublin City, which came to be known as Bloody Sunday. Brian, when people think of Bloody Sunday, they tend to think of what happened in Croke Park, but the prelude to that and effectively the reason for what happened in Croke Park happens at 9 o'clock in the morning or on the morning of the 21st of November. It's a series of coordinated killings. Tell us what happens around the city centre and outskirts of the city centre of Dublin on that day.
So at a number of locations that have been identified, members of the Dublin Brigade, so you have members of the squad, but also men drawn in from other units in the Dublin Brigade. They arrive at a set of targets, houses that they've been assigned to. And these were supposed to be houses occupied by members of the British intelligence organisation. And this was an attempt to cripple or wipe out British intelligence in Ireland. Now, whether they achieved that or not is a matter for debate, but the events itself have taken on this sort of iconic idea. We sort of assume that, you know, this is a simple case of men going in and wiping out the entire British intelligence operation. But actually, you know, the nitty gritty for it is much more dirty, I suppose, as well. You have men who are shot in their pyjamas, you have men who are shot in front of their wives or in close proximity to their wives. And just in the way that what happens in Croke Park is nasty and it's brutal, what happens in the morning is also nasty and brutal, if in a very different way.
Cathy, you've been looking at local involvement in and on Bloody Sunday. What have you come up with?
Well, I had to look through all the casualties to see if I could find anything that would relate to my area of Dublin. And I found one, Joe Traynor. He was actually born in Drimna Castle. His family worked on the farm that was associated with Drimna Castle. He'd been born there in 1900. And he lived pretty rural, average life, I suppose, in and around the Nace Road, Bluebell, Robin Hood part of Dublin. So by Bloody Sunday, he is actually a captain of his local GAA club, Emmett's GAA near Fox and Geese. And he attends the match along with his friend, a chap called PJ Halpin. And he's in the canal end. And when the shots start being fired at the actual game, he makes his escape from the canal end, and as he's trying to get over the wall, is shot twice. Now, trying to portray that in a day prior to even radio, prior to Facebook, Twitter, whatever we have, this account is carried home by the friend who'd been at the match with him, and he makes his way home, and word doesn't get home until later that night to a small cottage in Ballymount.
One of the other things I think we should keep in mind as well about Bloody Sunday is what doesn't happen, in the sense that a number of the targets don't work out. Men show up at the house and the person they're looking for either isn't there. In some cases, Todd Andrews being an example of that. He's one of these men from a Dublin unit who's brought in to take part. I think he's probably a little bit glad in some senses that the target he'd looked for wasn't there when they showed up. So there are a number of abortive attempts, and also in some cases men who are assigned to different locations don't show up either as well. So even the morning, the events in the morning don't go exactly as they're supposed
to
go.
And I think also the number of targets is reduced. I think initially they were talking about possibly as many as 40 targets, but that's hugely reduced before it gets to the day.
Yeah, Cathal Brua personally narrows the list down because he feels in a number of cases there's not enough evidence. And that's again a good example of some of the different priorities amongst the leadership of the IRA. You know, Colin's attitude in terms of who he feels are targets and how they war should go out versus Brua, who has a much more, you might say, conservative attitude. Mm.
Collins is not as worried about potential collateral damage, perhaps, as Cathal Brua is.
No, Brua is very concerned about the reputation of the IRA and how the IRA is going to look. I think Richard Mulcahy is of a similar mindset in a lot of ways.
We'll move on to then what happens in the afternoon. And Michael, the match that day, as we've talked about, Tipperary versus Dublin, it was only a challenge game. It wasn't a championship match. It was what we would suppose you could call a friendly. So one wonders, given what happened on the morning of the 21st of November, why did it go ahead?
Well, a few reasons, I would say, Miles. Number one, the fact that there were so few games on at the time, it drew a huge crowd. There was around 15,000, roughly speaking, went to Croke Park that day. So number one, you had an issue of crowd control. One of the sadder aspects of the story is that the GAA had gotten some sense and some notice that something might occur before the game. Harry Colley, Sean Russell and Tom Kilcoyne, three IRA men, got word from their sources in the Metropolitan Police that there was a security presence coming to Croke Park. So they made their way to Croke Park. They looked for Luke O'Toole, the General Secretary of the GAA at the time, and explained the situation to them, that they didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but that there was certainly a security force coming to Croke Park. And given the events of the morning, would they not consider stopping the game? Now, at this stage, the stewards had already been withdrawn. Normally, that time, O'Toole's GAA club, who would have had a very strong presence in E Company, the 2nd Battalion of the IRA, and would have had a huge number of players involved in the Easter Rising, have a huge history in that revolutionary period. They would have provided stewards back that time, but they had withdrawn all their people. They had always said there was no stewards. So O'Toole considered a couple of things, and number one was the crowd element. He felt, and this was after consultation obviously with other GAA people, he felt that actually trying to evacuate the place could possibly cause more of a panic than security forces coming. And we have to keep in mind, like, at this stage, no one could possibly imagine what was going to follow. They were just thinking of a kind of a crowd control issue. Secondly, there was the whole question of the GAA and their kind of, I suppose, publicly apolitical stance on these matters, that they were driving on with their games regardless of the politics, regardless of the War of Independence occurring around them. They didn't want to be seen to be impacted by events beyond their control, like the killings in the morning. So in the heel of the hunt, the compromise that they came to was that they would close the turnstiles at that point and wouldn't allow anybody else in. So the turnstiles closed, but there's a, I suppose, harrowing against sight of or the harrowing thought of one of the IRA men. His mother lived up on Clonliffe Road, and he's walking up Jones's Road and takes a right onto Clonliffe Road behind what's now Hill 16. He's walking up to his mother's house and he sees the turnstiles closed. And he can also see the swell of people gathering around the turnstiles, and he notices one turnstile operator throws his hands into the air and clicks open the turnstiles again, and all the turnstiles along the way click open and the people start to enter, and he just kind of, what can you do, kind of reaction, and goes in to his mother's for his dinner, and it's not long afterwards he hears the shots outside. So
it was crammed on the day. It was an almost a capacity crowd? How many thousands of people would you have got into Croke Park in those days, do we know?
Well, we're talking around 15,000 for that day, which was a serious number. You know, again, as we were saying earlier on, even though the games had slowed down to almost a full stop, you were still getting crowds for those games. So, I mean, the idea of going to Croke Park for the security forces, and it was, I mean, it's, I suppose up the years it's become sort of calcified in memory as a retaliation, a reprisal. It started out as a search operation, but I mean, from the very word go, it was completely flawed. It was a ridiculous idea to go to Croke Park on that particular day and expect a search operation to be carried out nice and calmly and in an orderly fashion.
OK, let's hear a clip from the RTE radio archives. This is Bill Ryan, a survivor of Bloody Sunday. He was playing for Tipperary on the day of the massacre. And here he's being interviewed by Donacha O'Dooling.
Where were you playing in the team?
At right half back.
Did you go to Dublin that morning, or when did you go?
I went the night before, Saturday evening.
And was there a big crowd at the game?
I'd say about 10,000 or 12,000.
Now, can you remind us what happened when Bloody Sunday began?
Well, the first thing happened, an aeroplane came over the playing pitch, circled around over the pitch, and went away. The next thing happened, I think it was the auxiliaries that came in the canal gate, and they fired 3 shots in succession. We were playing into the railway goal. I was out the field maybe about 50 yards at the time. I looked back and I saw all the crowd rushing around at the canal end. And the next thing I saw, Mick Hogan and a Dublin player coming running in my direction. So I turned and ran down the field the same way. A Dublin player was running in front of me and I followed him. And he crossed the wires now about the end of the Cusick stand. He crossed over the playing pitch. But I could hear the bullets whizzing and I followed them out of the playing pitch. And I thought that up to that time that it was blanks that were firing.
Bill Ryan there, a Tipperary player, describing his experience of Bloody Sunday at Croke Park. Michael, first of all, who was it? Was it the TANs? Was it the Oxies? Was it the RIC? Was it British soldiers? Was it a combination of a number of different forces? Who was actually doing the firing?
Yeah, it was a kind of a mix. The British Army were there, but they actually encircled the ground. And the idea of them being there was to ensure an orderly evacuation after this notion of a search operation. The people who actually did the firing were Black and Tans auxiliaries and some RIC. So they would have come in from the, if people are kind of aware, I suppose, of the geography of Croke Park and the area around it, they came up O'Connell Street, down Mountjoy Square, down what would be Fitzgibbon Street now, and parked their trucks, I suppose. The first truck was parked at the brow of Jones's Road Bridge. So they were all snaking back up the way. So when it came to disembarking, of course, the idea was that they were to fall into rows and get their orders. But what actually happened instead was the first couple of trucks were emptied and those RIC, Black and Tans and Auxiliary, started firing immediately. And we know that the first victim was an 11-year-old boy called William Robinson. He was from Little Britain Street, down below in the Ormond slums. And at that time, you had the canal end was really just a bank with a bit of a wall. And what we know now with the Hogan stand was a couple of stands, but there was some trees in the corner. So William, being 11 years of age, and I would imagine by the sounds of things, had been there before, he knew that the best place for an 11-year-old to watch that game would have been up in the trees. So he climbed the tree, and we kind of know from the autopsy reports now, looking back, that he probably turned when he heard the sound of the trucks behind him. And as he turned, the first shot rang out and went straight through his shoulder and out the other shoulder, and he fell from the tree. So he was the very first victim.
And a number of people were crushed to death in the chaos that resulted when the bullets started flying.
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, again, I suppose if people can imagine the geography of Croke Park, the shots are coming from that corner, from the canal end, from the junction of the canal end and what we now know as the Hogan Stand. So obviously, when the shots started, everybody started running in the opposite direction. So they're running up towards the Cusack stand, they're running up the Hogan stand, they're running towards Hill 16. It only lasts 90 seconds. I think that's an important thing to remember as well. All of this occurs in 90 seconds. So Black and Tans auxiliaries enter the field and they literally just start firing at knots of people running away. So in Joe Traynor's case, that's what happened to him. He was in a knot of people trying to climb the wall. He got shot in the back, got carried to a house down below in Sackville Gardens and died there, where there's actually still a plaque on the wall of the house where he passed away. Others, as you said, there was a crush. Up on the far left, there was a large gate kind of at the junction of the top of the Hogan and Hill 16. So there was a few people crushed there. You had the case of Jane Boyle, who was a 27-year-old. She was there with her fiancé. They were due to be married the following Friday. And she was kind of around the halfway line on the Cusack stand side when the shooting started. And they tried to run towards the top right-hand corner junction of the Cusack and the hill, and she had her hand in her fiancé's hand, and shots were ringing out, and sadly she was shot in the back, and her fiancé recalled afterwards that he could feel her hand slipping away from his hand, and she was trampled. When you get into the nitty-gritty of these things, I suppose we've all been reared with the sort of with the numbers and the a sense of what all of these episodes were about, but when you actually dig down a little bit and just scrape away a little bit of the dirt from these, they were really, really harrowing scenes and events.
And Brian, was this a bit of a propaganda disaster for the British? Because in a sense, it mitigated the brutality of what had taken place in the morning, which was, you know, perhaps a military coup for the IRA, but a propaganda coup for the British. But what happens in the afternoon completely dissolves any benefit that they get from what happened in the morning.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the British gain nothing from what happens in Croke Park. And in one sense, it sets the terms in which we understand the conflict. So it's setting the terms that people understand the conflict while it's happening. And that legacy lives on. This is one of those events that you think of when you think of the brutality of the British. And that's what it does at the time. And that's what it still does now. And that's where its big impact is in terms of how it helps us understand who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, what the narrative is, what the story is.
Now, obviously, the British, Michael, I presume, would have had a very different attitude to who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. So what was the British reaction to Bloody Sunday, to the two elements of Bloody Sunday? Which did they underscore and which did they tend to ignore? Or did they encompass both of them?
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, at their narrative was obviously going to be very, very different to the Irish narrative. In terms of the morning killings, that was an absolute, I mean, it was just an atrocity of the highest order. It was something that was almost unconscionable in their minds that this could actually occur. In terms of the afternoon killings, in terms of the conversation in Britain, it wasn't really mentioned. It was passed over. The first dispatches that come out of Dublin Castle that night, there's three different dispatches, three different statements. All of them insist that the firing came from inside Croke Park first and that there was a cache of revolvers found and various different things, none of which actually turn out to be true. But there's a couple of inquiries afterwards into the killings in Croke Park, the Jervis and Matter inquiries, they were called, after the two hospitals where most of the injured and the dead were taken. And both of those came to the conclusion that the shots came from inside, even though there's absolutely no corroborating evidence whatsoever to say that that occurred. In terms of British media, in terms of British politics, it's very interesting to see what occurs. In the House of Commons itself, you had an incident a couple of days afterwards. There was questions asked about the events in Croke Park by Joe Devlin, who was an Irish MP, Irish Party MP from the Falls Road in Belfast. There's so much talk about what had occurred in the morning. Joe Devlin asked the question, what about the people who were killed in Croke Park? And the reaction is absolutely caustic in the chamber, to the point that another MP, a Major John Molson, reaches back to Devlin and catches him in a headlock. And a kind of a bout of fisticuffs breaks out. The chamber has to be suspended, order has to be restored, and they resume parliamentary business again. So, you know, they don't want to talk about this. They just want to stick to the official line.
And no comparisons are made with Amritsar, for example. Well, I mean, the fatality figures you can't compare. There's no doubt about that. But still, the brutality.
Yeah, well, I was just mentioning the British media there. It's very interesting, again, to see the divergence. So back that time, some British newspapers would have had journalists based in Dublin. Others wouldn't. Others would have taken their official statements from Dublin Castle and gone that way. But Amritsar does come up because, you know, it's barely a year since that had occurred in India. So a newspaper, for example, like the Daily News, which I suppose would, the 21st century version would probably be the Guardian or something like that, would be looking at Croke Park and Amritsar as examples of the British government simply unable to govern now, to properly govern their empire. If you look across the tabloid newspapers at the time, I mean, there were stories about the IRA now bringing the war to the British mainland, that we're going to infect the water supply with typhoid. Cotton warehouses and timber yards in Liverpool were set alight by Irish agitators. The barriers went up in Downing Street to protect the street itself. There was a fear that there was going to be an attack by the IRA in cars. They were going to bulldoze their way through and go straight for 10 Downing Street. Houses of Parliament were closed to visitors. I suppose, in a way, it was very much like it is now when we talk about the war on terror in Britain and so on. The same sense of fear, the same sense that an unknown enemy was coming to get them was very much at play in the media and among the public in Britain that time.
And apparently some of the graves of the victims of Bloody Sunday remained unmarked for quite a while. Or are they still unmarked even?
Yeah, well, it was, again, even funerals are interesting. I mean, in terms of the victims in the morning, they were, those coffins were brought on gun carriage to Dublin Port and brought across to London, and they got the full regalia of funerals in Westminster Abbey and Westminster Cathedral. The contrast with the victims from Croke Park in the afternoon, all the families were told there were to be no flags, no shows of strength, as it were. But I mean, the vast majority of the families weren't connected to the IRA or any kind of revolutionary activity at all. They just wanted to bury their dead. And as you say, yeah, a lot of the victims, out of the 14 victims, 8 of them actually ended up in unmarked graves for various different reasons, from finance to families not wanting to draw attention to the fact that their loved ones had been killed at Croke Park or had had any kind of connection at all to revolutionary activity in that regard. And I suppose up the generations, that kind of continued. And I suppose, you know, often is the way with families, these things kind of get half forgotten. But thanks be to God, in the last few years, certainly after I did the work on the book, it was something that was stuck in my head, was the 8 and the unmarked graves. That seemed like something that needed to be corrected. So in the last 4 years, the GAA set up the Bloody Sunday Graves Project in conjunction with families to offer them the option to put up gravestones if they wish. So there's 4 up as it stands and 4 to go. So hopefully it'll be done by the centenary next year.
The centenary, yeah. And of course, that's parts 1 and part 2 of Bloody Sunday. Often forgotten, often ignored, is Bloody Sunday part 3, because in the aftermath of the assassinations and then the retaliation in Croke Park, the murders in Croke Park, Michael Collins' DMP agent David Nelligan was pressed into service to see if he could locate the 2 leading Dublin IRA commanders, Dick McKee and Pather Clancy. They had gone missing, along with somebody who was uninvolved in the conflict, Conor Clune, a Gaelic League member.
The prisoners were in the castle, in the custody of the auxiliaries, and as good as dead. A fantastic story of an escape by these 2 men was put out later by the castle authorities as an excuse for murdering them. Actually, McKee, Clancy and Clune had been murdered by the auxiliaries as a reprisal in the guardroom in Exchange Court, next door to and inside the castle gate. Collins was extremely upset over the disappearance of McKee and Clancy and wanted them rescued at all costs.
The words there of David Nelligan. In the case of McKee and Clancy, I mean, Clune, Brian, first of all, Clune has nothing to do with anything very much, does he really?
Seems to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, he's a Gaelic League member and he's certainly interested in the national cause, and there's a reason he's in the room when the police come in. But in terms of what the people who are raiding that house are looking for, he's just very unfortunate in terms of where he is. And then I suppose in terms of the timing, if he'd been arrested somewhere else and was held somewhere else at a different stage, you know, but being where he was after the events of the morning and afternoon of Bloody Sunday, that really didn't help.
Now, McKee and Clancy are undoubtedly brutalised. They're tortured or they are beaten up before they are shot. And I mean, I've even seen mocked up photographs, these extraordinary mocked up photographs. Just describe what Dublin Castle did to try and pretend that they were shot trying to escape.
I suppose one of the things that is interesting about this is how the British failed to set the narrative. So the British send out that story, you know, they send out the pictures, they send out the story that these people are shot while trying to escape. Similarly, as Michael has described with the events in Croke Park as well, they have inquiries, official inquiries, that are saying the firing came from inside Croke Park. But what's intriguing about all this is that nobody seems to buy it. So they make a very clear and concerted attempt to set the narrative and to tell a story, and really nobody buys it. And in that way, there's a parallel with the Bloody Sunday later on in 1972, where, you know, there's the official British narrative and there's what everyone else knows happened. So it's a real failure in their sense of trying to, you know, I mean, the fact that they're not telling the truth doesn't do them any favours. But really, they fail miserably to get the story out and get people to believe the story that they want them to believe.
But it is a big loss for the IRA in Dublin, isn't it? The death of McKee and Clancy.
Yeah, it's the OC and it's the vice OC. And, you know, McKee is a hugely important figure in the reorganisation of the Dublin Brigade after 1916, the reorganisation of 17 to 18. Pather Clancy is, again, one of these figures who's very highly looked up to. Their deaths basically mean the Dublin IRA has to reorganise again, and they have to reorganise on a couple of occasions. And I suppose it shows some of the challenges they face, but also maybe their successes in that they do adapt to these very significant losses as well, and they keep going.
Now, in another programme, we looked in detail at the burning of the Custom House on the 25th of May 1921 and the events surrounding it. But as we're focusing on Dublin tonight, it's important to address this engagement in the war. Brian, the Dublin Brigade lost a lot of volunteers in the Custom House or after the Custom House raid, didn't they?
Yeah, the Custom House is a real disaster. Five killed and you know, between 70 and 80 odd arrested. So it takes out a large chunk of the active service unit. They also lose men from a number of other units as well. And it again, it forces a reorganisation. So they have to keep going. The squad, the ASU are merged to form the Dublin Guard. Now, it comes, you know, the war doesn't carry on. There's a truce relatively quickly after the Custom House, which maybe mitigates the impact a little bit in the sense they don't have to continue fighting in that way for quite as long as they might have done if there wasn't a truce in July. But certainly, again, it's another major disaster. And when we talk about these events, something like Drumcondra, something like Bloody Sunday, losing McKee and losing Clancy, and then also what happens in the Custom House, it's the most active men who are being lost here as well. So that's significant. It's the guys who are at the forefront of the military activity in the city.
There are some pretty active men in the Dublin Fire Brigade, Cathy, because the Dublin Fire Brigade's involvement in the Custom House and in their attempts, in some instances, not to put out the fire in the Custom House is very, very interesting. But that's another story. Tell us about the hijacked fire engine.
Yes, it's all part of the whole Custom House arrangements. As you know, they had hijacked Tower Street Station. So as the calls are coming in, please send a fire brigade, the Custom House is on fire, they're actually being answered by the volunteers, the IRA.
In Tower Street. Yeah.
In conjunction with that, in Thomas Street, which would have been reasonably near the Custom House, the fire engine there had actually been removed from the premises and driven out to Crumlin and brought in a little joyride in the general area. And
probably a cat up a tree or something.
Oh, something terribly important was happening in Crumlin that particular day. Fire engine was missing for 2 hours. So it's abandoned in a field in a farm up in the Crumlin area. But this is all part of the narrative of, shall we say, the whole events of the Custom House itself. And again, it shows that, I would say, the workers, the fire brigade men, they're basically involved in the whole thing and they're involved in the whole arrangements, and their non-cooperation certainly helps in the burning of the Custom House itself.
And then just to finish, Brian, with the squad and the fate of the squad, what happens to the squad after the War of Independence?
Well, a number of the squad are involved in the Civil War. So the Dublin Guard, which is the amalgamation of the squad and the active service unit, they become key to the what becomes known as the Battle for Dublin during the Civil War. And then they're sent down south.
Did they remain loyal to Collins?
Yeah, so generally, again, that's one of the ways you can see kind of Collins' legacy lives on in that sense. In terms of how a lot of these very active members of the squad and the ASU, the side they fall on in the Civil War is often, if not exclusively, but very much largely dictated by their loyalty to Collins. So, you know, the treaty is good enough for Collins, therefore it's good enough for us. I think you can see that elsewhere as well. And personal loyalties to individuals certainly impacts on how people group together and how collectives decide on the treaty split. But it's very obvious in Dublin with that loyalty to Collins.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Our thanks tonight to my guests, Brian Hughes, Catherine Scuffle and Michael Foley, and also to the archivists in the Military Archives for their assistance with this programme. Excerpts from the Bureau of Military History witness statements were read by Simon Delaney, Cathy Rose O'Brien and Malcolm Adams. Our researcher is Liz Gillis, and on sound tonight was Mark McGrath. Join us at the same time next week when we'll be continuing our series on the War of Independence, and you can find podcasts of all our episodes on our website, rte.ie/history. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.